Are we on?
Hey, Jude.
All right.
Yep.
I can't see you, Robbie.
So can I.
Okay, there we go. All right. Today I have the great fortune of discussing COVID and vitamin D with Robbie Jolly. He is a biomedical engineer and the founder of Genesis System. I guess you call it PVT LTD.
And yeah, private limited.
Yeah, private limited. They do it a little different in your country. Over here, it's LLC, I think. But whatever.
Oh yeah.
I'm not
a. Doesn't matter.
I'm not a lawyer or an accountant.
Neither am I.
I don't know those things that well. But he's been doing active research in arterial stiffness for over 20 years. He's a good friend of mine, a brilliant scientist, and like all of us, curious. And with COVID and such, he's, you know, like all of us, trying to find a way to boost his immune system and protect ourselves crazy virus. And he actually was able to draw up and have it funded a study in India concerning vitamin D3. But let's backtrack a little bit and start with just what initially got you interested, Ravi, in vitamin D3.
Oh, well, before I begin, I'll just tell you a small funny story.
Sure.
On vitamin D3. This was in 1920s in the U.S. The vitamin D3 availability was very wide and open. And on an average, people were having about 20, 25 mg per day. Okay. And there were about 6,000 odd hospitals at that point in time. And they came to a stage of bankruptcy.
Oh, wow.
Because everybody was healthy and there were virtually no admissions. Okay. And then FDA, of course, and the big pharma, lots of fight. And you know what they did? The first thing they did was, instead of making vitamin D3 25 mg, they changed the unit to 1 million IU. Okay.
Wow.
So 1 million IU, if I'm going to be consuming, the label itself is quite scary. Okay. So that's the story of vitamin D3, how it was suppressed. And it was a long battle, of course. Then it went on till late 80s before the courts opened it up. So that was in a nutshell. And vitamin D3, of course, is required for a good, strong immune system. But there are a variety of other things, you know, in any pathies which claim to kind of strengthen your immune system. But the right. only difference, apart from vitamin D3 being very vital for umpteen number of reasons, the only difference between these two are, here it is measurable, so it is scientific. You can say, okay, I'm sitting at 70, 80 nanograms per ml. Okay, that's good for me.
Right.
But if you go for any other pathy, any other drug or supplement or whatever, right, which claim to give better immunity, but there's no gauge for it. There's no science behind it in the sense you can't measure it.
Right.
Right. So thereby, vitamin D3 there is one up on everybody. Right. And then our virtually every part of our body has, organ has vitamin D receptors.
Right.
Okay. And it's just like food, you need it every day.
Exactly. Okay.
And then there are vitamin D receptors in the body. Okay. And unfortunately, the dosages which are being given by doctors are too very low. It's like if you have hunger for a whole pizza and I give you just one piece, so that's neither here nor there. Something similar is happening with vitamin D3. But
right.
In all, it is very, very essential, like, especially in COVID times or otherwise as well. I would say that the vitamin D3 level should be anywhere between 60 to 80 nanograms per ml. And this should be maintained.
Right.
I mean, 60 to 80, I would call as a good, strong immune system. Okay. It can battle influenza and whatnots. Okay.
Right.
And then when we talk about autoimmune diseases, then of course, yes, then we have to go beyond 110 nanograms and be around 150 or so. 110, 140, as you suggest. Right. between 110 and 140. That is where the therapeutic effect steps in. Right. But another main fallacy which is being done by a majority of the prescribing clinicians is that they do not give magnesium. Okay. Right. Magnesium is a very, very essential cofactor. Okay. Magnesium is the one which, you know, works on the cellular level. And that is where vitamin D3 goes in and the receptors open, the fat goes down, the parathyroid hormone starts coming down, and the management of calcium and phosphorus is being done. So that's when it starts happening at a reasonably good level, 60, 80. And as I said, for any other autoimmune disease like MS, Parkinsonism, and joint bone issues. And that's what it is in a nutshell.
Right. A lot of people don't understand vitamin D isn't even a vitamin. It's actually a hormone. It has receptors.
It is a hormone, of course.
And a lot of people, 30% of regular people and 40% of obese people actually have a defect either in the vitamin D receptor or the intercellular machinery that activates vitamin D. And so to overcome that, those people frequently need higher levels. Those are the people that are frequently the ones that have autoimmune diseases and, you know, more symptoms of vitamin D deficiency. You were able to have a study funded in India. Can you tell us something about that?
Yeah, I'll come to that. But apart from the gene defect, which you just mentioned, I have also noticed the role of vitamin B12. If B12, I've treated people. I mean, this gentleman I had close to about 20 lakh I use, and his vitamin D was sitting at about 12.
Right.
Okay. And that was over a period of like 4 or 5 months. Then he got his B12 checks. His B12 was 64. 64.
Wow.
Ideally, it should be 700 to 800. And then we put him on to B12, and vitamin D shot up to 100.
Wow. I did a lot of research trying to find a connection between B12 and vitamin D3, and I couldn't find much of anything in the literature.
No, how I identified was that when I got his thyroid TSH done, his T3, T4, and TSH, his TSH was in decimal points. I've never seen that kind of a thyroid. Total stimulating hormone was like decimal point 3 or something. Okay. Whereas it should be sitting at about 5 or so. So based on that, then I suspected B12, although I didn't see the connection. It was a gut connection, which I thought. And when we did the B12, and once we increased it, his TSH came up to 2.5. That is wonderful. It should be ideally between 2 to 2.5. And it sat there. So B12, thyroid. Initially, whenever I go into the vitamin D therapy for anybody, usually I recommend that they do a vitamin D test, ionic calcium, TSH, and B12. And not to forget the PTH, of course. So
yes,
that gives us a base value. And then we can go aggressively. Okay.
Right.
And if not, and you know, by default, it's very conservative to say that 75 to 80% world population is deficient in vitamin D. Okay. Having said that, so if you just want to have a good, strong immune system, 60 to 80 nanograms is sufficient. So you give a dosage and be, you know, done with it, and then give a maintenance dose. So that takes care of it. But if you are going into the therapeutic mode, okay, then you have to monitor these other parameters on a regular basis, at least between 3 to 4 months once, and then see where the trend is going. Because vitamin D3 has the tendency of pulling out calcium, but it depends on the diet. Okay, you face a lot of hypocalcemia cases. Here, we face hypocalcemia. So here we have to give external supplement calcium here. Okay, because your food is fortified. These are the guiding factors for us to treat the patient and get fantastic outcomes.
Right. Well, it's interesting because so often, the some of the main things that are kind of linked together is a vitamin D3 deficiency and vitamin B12. A lot of people in the Facebook group, the private Facebook group, Vitamin D Advocacy, that I started, I'm seeing a lot of people from the UK that seem to have, in particular the UK, a vitamin D3 deficiency and a B12 deficiency. The vitamin D3 deficiency is not, I mean, that's everywhere, but it's not surprising because the further you get from the equator, you know, the less ultraviolet light, the less, you know,
true.
Sunshine you get.
Yeah. And that's the sunlight, and that too, the sunlight has to be between 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., and then you have to be kind of semi-nude. You know, legs absorb about 36%, so they are covered, spotless, and so on. And then excessive sun has its own drawbacks, of course.
Right. Yeah, it's really a big problem in Europe because in that area in Italy, northern Italy, where they had the super high rate of COVID, the actual 75% of people had a vitamin D level of 5 nanograms per ml, which is, you know, thousands and thousands of people. And I maybe found 6 or 7 that had a level that low. Yet here's a population that 75% of the people had such a low level. And it was devastating. I mean, a huge number of people died, which, you know, basically with that low level of vitamin D, you essentially have no immune system.
Correct. That's true. In fact, I'll just show you this one paper. I don't know whether you can see it. This is a paper on nephrology.
Right.
And this one says that people with CKD or other kidney diseases, about 95% of these patients are vitamin D deficient.
Wow.
95%. Can you believe it? That is a huge, big number. So you're right there.
Yeah, it's interesting because essentially any disease of aging you look at is essentially, in my opinion, associated with vitamin D deficiency. You know, whether it's atherosclerosis or dementia or autoimmune diseases, which really aren't more diseases of aging, but you name it, and it has an association with vitamin D deficiency. You know, as they say, it doesn't mean it causes it, but I believe that there's a strong correlation with having a low vitamin D, because vitamin D is critical for deep restorative sleep, for having a really robust immune system, and for metabolism. You know, almost everybody, not everybody, but almost everybody, when they started on what I consider the optimal dose to achieve optimal blood levels, which are higher than what you're saying, 100 to 140 nanograms per ml. And over in Europe, they use nanomoles per liter, which is 2.5 times greater. So essentially 250 to 300.
Yeah, so just divided by 2.5, and you get nanomoles.
Right. And, you know, sorry, I just lost my track of where I was going.
Well, that's okay. I'll cover that. We were talking about the study, right?
You know, it doesn't surprise me that people with kidney disease, because, you know, it's interesting. Somebody wrote into the group recently and talked about having kidney stones, and they were concerned if they took higher levels of vitamin D that and had higher blood levels that they would get more kidney stones. And really, I found the opposite, that people had fewer. And you know, this study with a correlation of vitamin D deficiency, you said 95%. I mean, that is just amazing, basically.
Yeah, it's amazing, you know, and unbelievable.
Yeah. I mean, but that's the thing about vitamin D is, you know, it's like, I mean, how many times in our life have we heard some miracle cure, some miracle something, you know, noni juice or whatever, that, you know, vitamin C, you know, and people are just kind of like blasé. They like, you know, I've heard this before. It all turns out to be nothing.
True. See, vitamin D, I would like to call it, as like the earth. And magnesium is like the moon.
I missed that.
Okay.
Like the
I said, for me, vitamin D is like the earth, planet earth.
Okay.
And magnesium is your moon.
Okay.
Okay. They go around each other. They have to be in synergy. And then they have two little babies called as K2 and boron.
Yes.
Okay. And for example, and especially in the US context, when you are developing hypercalcemia, right? So an intake of K2 would be very, very essential and helpful. K2, the MK71. Right. And people with bone joint issues, they should be having boron.
Yes.
See, basically, what is vitamin D doing? It's taking out the calcium, right? And magnesium is metabolizing it. Okay, K2 is taking it to the bone, right? But they're just pasting over it. Boron is the one who's cementing it. Okay. See, the bone should be like a twig, okay, from a branch. When it falls, it doesn't break. It bends a little, okay. Because bones are not supposed to be hard. Okay. They just don't crack. They're not supposed to crack. So right. When these are used in combination, then of course, for the bone, and there are reports, some reports that with regular intake of boron, there might be an increase in the BMD, the bone mass density.
Right.
Okay. And so, you know, it all revolves around vitamin D, as I see it. And then you keep adding cofactors depending upon the ailment. And right. If you just want a simple, strong immune system, just aim for 60 to 80 nanograms and you'll be good there.
Yeah.
That's what is my opinion.
Yeah. The interesting thing about boron is over in Israel, they have a 0.5% incidence of osteoarthritis. And the only reason I have any is because of immigrants, because there's such a high level in the soil and in their water.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Essentially get no, zero osteoarthritis. And what the reason behind that, I think, is, like you say, boron makes the bone like a twig on a tree. You know, it's flexible, but not brittle. And I think when you have that kind of bone, it better absorbs the shock, and all the shock isn't put on the cartilage. And so
absolutely,
you don't end up
without
the cartilage. And I mean, you know, think about how many professional sports players' careers would have been extended if it wasn't for their knees, you know, or their shoulders giving out. And if they only took, you know, vitamin D, you know, I say at optimal levels, and take boron and the magnesium, you know, and K2, they might have extended their career, you know, several years.
Absolutely. I
mean, how much money, you know, how much enjoyment we would get watching our favorite, you know, whether it's cricket in India or, you know, whatever sport in the U.S., we have like 80 that we seem to be fascinated. Yeah.
That's true.
You know.
The moot point around all this is that the magic is in the doses. Okay. And if we go by the RDAs, then of course, nothing is going to be happening. Absolutely nothing. Right? So the magic is certainly in the doses.
Yeah. Well, the big pharma was the one that got the RDAs. I mean, for vitamin D, they recommend 600 IUs a day. I mean, you might as
well. You'd rather not take it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we're not medical advice here, and people should check with their physician. And you know, there are some people that have, you know, genetic defects that can develop hypercalcemia. But even the few studies in the literature, the lowest dose I saw was 10,000 units a day where somebody, you know, and that was, you know, maybe there's 5 cases in the whole world where that happened.
Yeah, you're right. And I'd like to point out, once you're having boron, the requirement of vitamin D and magnesium might slightly decrease, because boron, we excrete magnesium, vitamin D, calcium, phosphorus through urine, and it reduces that by about 40%. So that is the bioavailability. That much more bioavailability is increasing in the body. Right. So based on that, you know, we just need to titrate and see here and there. That what exactly would be the requirement. But yes, it's entirely possible.
I mean, everybody's unique. I mean, you know, you and I discussed. Yeah.
We are like fingerprints. We are unique. And then, as you rightly say, there are, you know, low responders and high responders. And for that, it could be a gene defect or B12 deficiency or a faking a thyroid which is faked out. So that's where it goes. That's where it goes.
And that makes it, you know, I mean, thing is, people have so much going on these days and are so much information overloaded that a lot of times they like throw their hands up and go, you know, I don't know what to do. You know, I certainly don't want to harm myself. I mean, the one good thing is that there's no reported cases ever of somebody dying from vitamin D supplementation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I keep telling people that.
Ever dying.
I mean, that's true. Nobody has died.
People die from pharmaceutical overdoses. I mean, you know, the number of iatrogenic, which means doctor caused deaths, in the U.S. is, you know, I think tens of thousands a year. And yet, you know, if you took vitamin D, I mean, in my opinion, you won't end up a slave, or at least you'll prolong being a slave to pharmaceuticals to much later in life.
Very true. Very true. We just have to be careful in the context, two contexts actually. One is your hyper or hypocalcemia. And second, not over suppressing the parathyroid hormone. Okay. Right. Let's say the band is between 15 to 60 picograms per ml. And let's say we keep it at about 18, 19. We don't bring it to zero. Okay. So that we have to be careful. I mean, I would say give or take maybe 8 to 12 months of a treatment and maybe about 3 tests. One would find their final, what do you call, maintenance doses. Okay, this is what D is going to be for me. This is the doses for boron and so forth. A few tests and then, you know, you get going. And if you just have to maintain your immunity, then, of course, as we discussed, it's just D and MAG. Nothing else is required.
Yeah, I've come to believe that, you know, when I wrote my book, there was so much less known. I mean, it's amazing. And I wrote it in October of, or published it in October of 2018. And in 3 years, the tremendous amount more of, or that wasn't very well said, but how much more information there is on vitamin D and how much greater my understanding is of it. And I've come to believe that probably the best indicator, the best thing to measure is, like you say, the parathyroid hormone, even more than your, and, you know, I mean, certainly you don't want your ionized calcium. And a lot of people worry about hypercalcemia, but as you and I have noticed in so many people like ourselves, we tend towards, and especially in you, towards hypo. That's low calcium, ionized calcium.
That's right. That's right. You
check ionized calcium, as you say, and not
calcium. Now, it's similar to, like, you know, when you're checking the C-reactive protein, that is a broad indicator. Okay.
Right.
And when you take the high sensitivity CRP, right, that is more accurate. Similarly, just like, you know, for example, creatinine. Okay. Better indicator, serum creatinine.
Okay, yeah.
Creatinine. Okay.
Yeah.
Creatinine is an indicator, but a better indicator than creatinine is EGFR. Okay. And even better than EGFR is your cystan C.
Okay. Hang on.
So similarly, you know.
Keep on going. My phone's about to die. I got to grab the charger. Go, keep on going.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I apologize.
No, that's okay. That's okay.
Because I plugged it in this morning and sure enough, it, you know, what's
I'm sure it's Apple. Dude, yeah. I'm sure it's Apple.
Yeah, it is. And I've got
Apples die way faster.
Yeah, and I thought I did this right. Hang on.
Yeah.
I really do. This is just. All right, there we go.
Yep. Yeah.
All right. Go ahead. I'm sorry. You're talking about how you specifically, are you talking about creatinine and
Yeah. That's over. I was just saying that, you know, they're indicators, separate indicators, blood markers like creatinine, EGFR, and then cystancy and so on. Anyways, I'll tell you the study which we did on COVID.
Right.
I mean, actually, it is published. If you can just probably read it or not, I don't know. That's okay.
Yes, it's clear.
Yeah. Basically, our lead doctor, Dr. Neeraj Kumar from All India Institute of Medical Sciences, Patna, they have done it. And these were all hospitalized patients. And we had the category of mild, moderate, severe, based on the NIH guidelines. And what we did was we measured their arterial stiffness. Okay. And we have a product called Aspiroscope. And that is the one which does the testing. It's a very simple test. Just four BP cuffs are connected along with two ECG electrodes. And then it inflates and there are algorithms and all. And it kind of calculates the stiffness. What is stiffness? It's basically the velocity, pulse wave velocity. See, the origin, the pulse wave velocity is basically, you know, your heart doesn't pump like a tap. It doesn't go straight. It pumps like this.
Right.
Okay. So it's pulsatile. It's pulsatile. And as the heart arteries stiffen, that pulsatility goes away. Okay. A good example I can give you is when you buy a new hose pipe for your garden. Okay. It's very, very flexible. You put a foot over it, it stops. Okay. But right. When you're putting the foot over it, the pressure is on the tap. Tap is the heart. And the second condition is over a period of time of usage, there is a lining inside of algae or something. Okay.
Right.
When you hit the pipe, it cracks. Okay. That's a simple analogy which I'm trying to give you. So here, when the pulse wave velocity increases, okay, that is because there has been an endothelial dysfunction. Okay. Endothelial function is basically the one where nitric oxide is being released by the arteries, which keeps them palpable. Okay. They dilate and they accommodate. That is why you have perfusion pressure, coronary blood flow is fine. See, in, for example, I'm just going off the topic a little bit, just to explain it better. There are a set of people which you would have known who, after getting a bypass surgery, have become perfectly all right, back to pink of health and all energy and vigor. Okay.
Right.
And there are people who, after getting the bypass done, are as bad as they were earlier. Okay.
Right.
Why? Because their coronary blood flow and perfusion pressure is not increased. So if your aorta is compliant, okay, the perfusion pressure and the CBF will increase automatically. Okay. Now, if the aorta is not compliant, meaning that it is stiffened. So it is not able to accommodate that much blood for the heart to take it during diastole and systole.
Right.
Okay, so anyways, so what we did was, this was an observational study. And as I told you, based on the NIH guidelines, we had patients. And we realized that with COVID, the velocities are very high. I mean, I would, to give you a simple explanation, a person who is having a ESRD, end-stage renal disease, okay, for the past like maybe 7, 8, 10 years, his velocity and the severe patient's velocity are the same. Meaning in those couple of days or few days or 3 or 4 days, it has deteriorated, the arterial health is deteriorating that much in COVID, with COVID. That is what is the understanding which we got from the study, that pulse velocity is increasing, arterial stiffness is increasing very, very significantly.
Okay.
And unfortunately, what is happening is okay, the patient is RT-PCR positive, fine. You treat him with whatever guideline, standard of care, and then he becomes negative, you send him home. Okay.
Right.
What we have observed is he is leaving with a very high pulse wave velocity. Okay. So it is just a matter of time. The prognosis are not good. He can have a cardiovascular event in the next 6 months, 1 year. Okay. And that certainly is going to be happening because his arterial health is deteriorated. And what will happen? He'll have a kidney issue. What? See, basically, kidney is connected to arteries. All arteries are connected to all organs in the body.
Right.
Okay. There's no rocket science there. And then what they do is, artery is the branch which is feeding the kidney, per se, for the sake of discussion. And you are treating the fruit, which is the kidney. But you're not treating the branch, which actually supplies the nutrients. Okay.
Right.
So you're not going to get anywhere unless you do the treatment of arteries as well. Now, the problem is measurement. Pulse wave velocity is like electricity. You can't see it. You can only measure it. So you can't put a person into MRI and say that I'm going to do a complete scan. Nothing's going to come out of it. Right. So right. Management of pulse wave velocity or arterial stiffness is very, very important. That is what they now call it as, you know, long COVID. Long COVID is what? People are getting diabetes. People who did not have comorbidities. In fact, in our study, all these patients whom we have done or tested, none of them had comorbidities or hypertension or diabetes or any renal issue or neurological issue, nothing whatsoever.
Right.
These patients have elevated velocities. And we have another study going, which unfortunately right now is slowed down because there are very less COVID cases in the hospital. Here we are treating them with vitamin D, okay, and magnesium.
Right.
And we have to, it's too early to say anything. We've done about 38 patients. We need about 160 of them. And let's see, we'll come around there also. And that's going to be very interesting.
Right, right. And what is your, by treating with vitamin D, you're hoping to prevent them from having the stiffening of the arteries? Is that what the objective is?
You'll have to repeat it. I lost you.
Yeah, the objective of the study is to treat them with vitamin D to try to prevent their arteries from stiffening with the COVID.
Yeah, that, see, basically once when the patient is in COVID, okay, whether it's severe, non-ventilated, of course, mild, moderate, or severe. We are doing moderate and severe. Basically, what we are doing is we are giving heavy doses of vitamin D. Okay.
Right.
What is happening is basically cytokine storm, which is affecting the small artery and the large arteries. Okay. So vitamin D may not be doing anything directly to the arteries per se. Right. But it is working as a catalyst. When your immune system becomes stronger, see, humans have the best, most complicated, I think you will agree, humans are the most complicated machinery on earth.
Okay? Yes.
There's nothing more complicated and sophisticated than us.
No.
And when you have a problem, when you have a problem with your car, would you like to go to a local mechanic or the manufacturer? Obviously, the manufacturer. And manufacturer is within you. In this case, the manufacturer is within you. So what we are doing is we are not treating COVID. We are treating the body's requirement. Right. So we give it enough doses of vitamin D and huge doses. Right. Vitamin D has this typical character. It peaks at about, after ingestion, it peaks at about 16, 17 hours. Okay. And then it starts depleting for the next 24 hours or so. Right. So you giving vitamin D in divided doses is a very good idea. Why? Because once the peak is coming down, or the earlier dose, the second dose, second one is picking it up. Picking it up again. So that cycle continues. So we give heavy doses like between 3 to 5 days, and depending on. I have treated many friends and family, extended family and all, with vitamin D, right? And the only difference is it was just vitamin D, magnesium, blindly giving. Now we are trying to do it scientifically.
Right.
Okay. We are doing all the measurements. We are doing the initial, on admission, we are doing the arterial stiffness test. We are doing their IL-6. We are doing their various inflammatory parameters on the first day and then the discharge. So we are doing it very scientifically now. So that was initially, that was the inspiration. Oh, okay. Now this is happening. People are getting better and better. So that's how this study started, with that thought process, actually.
So when you say high doses, what for the audience, what do you mean by high doses that you're treating them with?
We have gone as high as 180,000 units per day.
Okay.
Along with 500 mg of magnesium. Now what we do is in our country we have 60,000 dose available. Right. We do one in the morning, one in the afternoon, one in the night. These are all post meals. Right, along with magnesium. So we give this for severe patients. I think we are giving it for like 4 days.
Right.
That is 180,000 units, 4 days. And then we are bringing it out to two, and then two continues till discharge, till 7 days actually. Right. By then, usually by the third day, we see the difference.
I think you told me with the initial virus, of course, it's mutated but it's mutated quite a few times since then, but you were having 100% success rate of having people rapidly recover, you know, from COVID with that protocol you just mentioned.
Yeah. You're right. This variant is slightly different. And in fact, if you come to look at it, I'm not very sure. First time in the first wave, it was very, very successful, right? And right now, it is taking a little more time, but it is doing its job.
Right.
Like maybe we have to look at the doses, take a relook at the doses again. And certainly, vitamin D for people. We've also discussed, I think, yesterday or day before, that what is the quantification of this virus? Okay. Now, can you say that little COVID has come to me, or medium or large?
Sorry, say it again.
And
say it again.
I said, what is COVID quantitative?
Right.
Is COVID quantitative? That it to people who have mild means they've had a little quantity of COVID, or the serious ones got a larger dose of COVID. I don't think so. A virus is a virus. Okay. So it is basically the immune health. Which makes and converts probably into the outcome of being mild, moderate, or severe. I think so, personally. I might be wrong. It's just a hypothesis. My possibility is there. Yeah.
Right. Right. So basically, COVID, as people say, is an inflammatory disease. And depending upon your cytokine production, if you get essentially a cytokine storm, you basically get severe inflammation in your arteries, and it's going to be prolonged. It does permanent damage to your arteries, if I'm understanding you correctly, and you're going to end up with all these comorbidity. English isn't my primary language later in life. Basically, it's accelerating your aging, which is, in my opinion, I think vitamin D slows your aging. There's things at the end of the chromosome called telomeres, and the longer they are, the more cell divisions you can go on, because you want cells, because if your cells die, you can't produce another cell to put in its place. Once the cells are really old, you end up putting scar tissue. That's why we get, I don't have them, but people that have wrinkles, that's a joke.
True.
But whereas a baby has that lush, plush skin, because they're replacing the dying cells with more cells. So basically, if COVID is accelerating the destruction of the ends of your chromosomes, your telomeres, you're basically left with nothing to replace it but scar tissue. And scar tissue is a lot more rigid than it are cells. And you're basically ending up with a steel pipe instead of a rubber one. It's kind of like you use the hose analogy. Your hoses at first are really nice, but here in Texas, after they've been baked in the sun for a while, they get rigid and you lose the, of course, it's probably hotter where you are in India than where I am in Texas, so I can't brag, but it's amazing stuff. I mean, that's really, really, I've never heard anybody say that before.
Yeah. Yeah. It does.
And have you seen any preliminary results so far with the vitamin D in your study? I mean, I know you've only had done 38 out of 160, I believe, but does it look good, bad? What are you thinking?
You'll have to repeat. I didn't get you.
Yeah, I apologize.
Well, just trailed off.
In your study, you have 38 patients. You need 160, and you were saying that it's too early to tell any results in your study, but that I was just wondering if to give any definitive results. But I was wondering if you've seen any positive results so far with the patients you're treating.
Yeah, we have. See, basically, what we have done is we have created four arms in this. Okay. Mild, moderate. Okay.
Okay.
In the first arm, we are having only observation of mild and moderate patients. They are on standard of care. Everybody is on standard of care.
Right.
That's the government guidelines. And then in the second group, what we are doing is we are giving the patient clindamycin and telmisartan. Okay. Doses differ. In the third group, we are giving only vitamin D and magnesium. Okay. And in the fourth group, we are giving 50% of both these groups. That means we are giving vitamin D, we are giving magnesium, we are giving clindamycin, we are giving telmisartan as well. Okay. And it's very interesting. We've had 3-4 patients in the fourth group, and that is the D group. And I mean, they seem to be recovering very fast. I should not be conclusive about it. It's too soon for that.
Sure. And you don't want to bias the study, but I mean, I just, some indication.
We are very optimistic.
If it was doing nothing, I mean, the thing is to be scientific, to be objective, because, they're going to try to tear this apart if it works. And so you need to make sure you have a really firm foundation, or else, they're going to say, it's fraud, or, it's just another one of those, fantastic cures that ends up to be nothing. But
the kind of testing we are doing, apart from doing the arterial stiffness test, we are doing all the blood markers as well. Okay.
Right.
So we are leaving no stone unturned. It's a very, very thorough scientific study. No two opinions about it.
Well, I've been stronger a lot. Yeah, I would expect no less from you, Ravi. I know how you are. So, and your colleagues, I'm sure it's a fabulous study. And I mean, you had to fight to get it to go because people didn't want to have it happen. But I think that's really fabulous. And it's hard these days to try to get any decent studies with vitamin D, because I think I found one study where they used doses that are even close to what I consider optimal, and either they use too low of doses, or they don't measure the blood levels or whatever. But it's we have a huge fight in front of us, and you, like I, really are a firm believer in vitamin D.
Of course.
But
you and me just have to read the dosages on a paper on whichever publication, we'll know the outcome.
Yes, exactly.
So this one is a failure, right?
I mean, why spend so much money? I mean, people need to ask this question. Why would anybody spend so much money on studies that show it doesn't work? I mean, why would you do that? Why would you? I mean, what's the definition of insanity? Doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. And what I think they've tried to do is do all these studies to prove it doesn't work, so that they can go back and say, see, it doesn't work. But
you take my drug.
Yeah.
It's all about money. Bottom line, it's all about money.
And
unfortunately, D is cheap.
And the thing is that people, I mean, medicine treats symptoms. It doesn't prevent diseases. And I mean, here's the thing is, and this is, I mean, doctors, I think, really want to do what's best for the patient. Unfortunately, I know in medical school, like for myself, you're brainwashed into thinking that if there's a problem, there's a pharmaceutical drug to solve it.
Yeah.
And I found, you know, and a doctor once told me, if you want to get a doctor's attention, talk about money. And it's kind of crass, but the point is, you know, after all that work and stuff, of course you want to make a decent living, you know?
But
I think doctors really, the majority really do care about their patients and really do want to make a difference. And a nice side effect of that is you make a good amount of money. But what I found is by doing what's right and making my patients healthier, I made more money. And it seems like, well, if you're getting them better, well, people still get ill, still have things happen to them. It may take longer, but if they trust you, they'll walk through walls to come find you, you know?
True.
So anyway, I don't want to take more of your time. I really, really appreciate you being here today and talking to me. And your research is really fascinating. And, you know, you're a great scientist, but more importantly, you're open-minded and curious. And, you know, so many people are so dogmatic. It's like my way or the highway. And, you know, if somebody could show that I'm wrong, I'm happy to change my opinion. I think like you are. We're constantly seeking the truth. And I think that's what most people are looking for. Unfortunately, they're being fed dogma and, you know, it's killing them.
Yeah, I'll explain it though. I know what you're saying. It's basically, you know, what as a team, what we are trying to do is treat the cause, not the effect.
Right. Right.
So if you treat the cause, the effect automatically goes. See, that's what is happening in COVID. Okay. There's oxygen requirement has gone down. Okay. There's a 90% saturation and then so on and so forth, other parameters. So basically, what are you trying to do? Giving him oxygen. And SOCs, and so basically, you are trying to alleviate the effect. The cause remains the same, and even right. these COVID patients, once they are discharged, they are not a healthy lot at all. Okay, unless you treat their arterial stiffness,
right.
Nothing is going to change. Nothing is going to change for the simple reason: each and every organ is connected with the arteries, so you can't deny that. Okay, so you have to normalize that at least to the best possible.
Okay. Yeah, there's for set example, up for
if somebody is, for the sake of discussion, let's say if the cutoff is 900 centimeter per second is, let us say, the normal value, and this patient is sitting at 1800, at least bring him to 1200.
Yeah.
If not normal, just the way we work with the brachial pressures.
Yeah, they're set up for an accelerated death. And they're desperately trying to find some solution. And, you know, medicine right now is initially ignored them, you know, poo-pooed them, said that they were just, you know, basically the last thing a patient ever wants to hear is basically it's all in your head. And what I used to tell patients is, you know, when a doctor says that, tell them back, yeah, because that's where my brain is, you know, it's all in my head because that's where my brain is. And, you know, but I mean, look, you need to work with your doctor. And I think if any doctors are listening to this is the key to take care of your patients. Measure their levels, get them on the right amount of vitamin D. You know, you care by looking for something that's going to help prevent them from an accelerated death. Certainly shows you're going to care. And, you know, and that's what they need to do, I think.
True. Very true.
Well,
that is very true. Very well said.
I hope they come around. Yeah, I think they will because there's so many doctors. If you look at YouTube and stuff, there's a lot of doctors out there questioning, you know, which is a good sign, my friend, a good sign. Well, I so appreciate your time. I know it's very late over there.
It's my pleasure.
And
it's always a pleasure talking to you, Judd.
Likewise. And you're doing some brilliant research, you and your colleagues. You know, please tell them how much I appreciate them being involved with this. And I'll talk to you soon. Yeah, anything else you want to say again before we leave?
let's find a solution to COVID.
There you go. All right. You have a good one. Take care.
Okay.
All right.
Good day. Bye-bye. Bye.